Todo este FSP.
Legal matters.
Simba Taguva is my guest director at Taguva Attorneys and a consultant to Mulatuli Incorporated. But Simba, good evening to you and thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening, Aubrey. Great to be back on the show.
Much, much appreciated. So we go into the second part of our conversation where we started to talk about some of the challenges in the running of a property investment where you've got tenants, hiring space in your building. And we talked about a number of challenges that suggested sometimes that the law is not on the side of the I keep getting all of these signals. Am I okay,
Simba? Yeah, I can hear you perfectly.
Ah, there you go, Simba. Okay, anyway, so I want to talk a little bit about what it is that an entrepreneur in that space, somebody who is looking to go into property investment, must do in order to protect themselves against the possibilities of errant tenants. But I also want to know a little bit more about commercial property and some of the issues that arise out of that, and perhaps stay on the same sort of conversation around errant tenants in that particular situation, given the laws that we have in the country. I'm aware, of course, that all of these things need to be understood in context. There are situations where the landlord himself is not, or herself is not doing the right thing in terms of the law, in terms of the best practices. But the question came to say, what do I do to look after my business, particularly when I'm dealing with a tenant that doesn't want to pay rent on time, that is not interested in playing ball in that sense? I suppose that's a good place to start, Simba.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, last time we had the conversation, we ended up really being absorbed with this particular question. But Aubrey, if you'll allow me, I think it is symptomatic of the reason why I thought this would be a good topic to raise for your listeners.
Yep.
Because even that, where you have a tenant and they're not paying or they're not doing what they should be doing, and now you struggle to find solutions, is a symptom of most of the times not having the right agreements and the right structures in place at the outset, that you can end up having the quick and easy recourse when the tenant starts to default. So I think that this is exactly what makes the conversation very important to have for somebody who is considering or who is already in property ownership and property investment, is you need to really think about how you are structuring your investments and how you are structuring your agreements with the different stakeholders. It's not just tenants. We also hear issues with the agents. We also hear issues between partners around the ownership, or sometimes with the funders of these businesses. So all of these things require some level of thought at the outset in order to proactively prevent or to mitigate at least the losses that you can end up incurring.
Sure. Well, let's get into it. I mean, how do we structure a business of that nature in order for us to protect ourselves if we are in that kind of business, without also being the breakers of laws, Simba? Because I think there's a very, very important balance to be kept here, that while we are looking to answer entrepreneurial questions, we should also remember that we live in a human rights environment, in an environment that respects the law. How do we do that for the person who wants to invest in property?
Yeah, so I think maybe the first question you have to ask yourself is, how exactly am I doing this? So if, for example, you are going into property investment by yourself, you want to do this either as an investment, a legacy investment for your family. You are, let's say, relatively high net worth, or you've got enough credit records to be able to apply for a loan and get it. And you want to do this to grow your wealth and your portfolio. Then in that sense, it's always better to structure it into a trust, have a trust, and have a PTY Limited, which is owned entirely by the trust. And then the PTY Limited then owns the property, because it simplifies your taxation cost base. And it also helps with succession planning. So because the ultimate holder of the benefit is the trust, you end up in a, let's say, a situation where if anything does happen to you, the inheritance issues are much, much less complicated. So it does give you certainty in succession planning, when the ultimate holder is this trust. If you're doing also multiple properties, so you don't just own one property, you've got a number of different properties, like a little portfolio of your own. That structure is also very efficient, because what you can do is you have all those operating properties in an entity, or you can even have them in separate entities if you want to. And then if one of the properties doesn't do well, for example, and you're now forced to sell it, it doesn't mess up your own individual track record or financial credit record, I should say.
Right.
So you sort of inure yourself from the risk if this doesn't go well. Then, of course, it also just allows for easier accounting for yourself on an ongoing basis. You can keep track. Am I doing well? Is my portfolio performing well? And if it comes to the moment where you need to sell the property, it's also a lot easier to do it out of a separate legal entity. It just tends to make it a lot easier and more efficient from a legal perspective. So that's at least from a, let's say, a mindset. At the outset, you have to decide, why am I doing this? What is my intention? If you want to go in with partners and maybe just buy, renovate, rent for a little bit, and then sell it at a higher value, then maybe there's no need to do a trust, for example, which is a fairly expensive legal entity to have, is a trust, right? There's so many legal requirements around it now, and you have to have trustees, and it's a bit pricey to operate.
Yeah.
But if you have partners and you're simply doing it as a business opportunity among friends or a stock fellow or what have you, then I think it's better just to put it in a PTY Limited. You have a shareholding structure. You get a shareholders agreement between you guys, and then you manage it in a much more efficient way. And you're all protected in your individual capacities in the event something does go wrong.
Why is it not just okay just to own the thing yourself as an individual?
So as I'm saying, the problem is that what is the intent at the end of the day?
Yeah.
Because if you want to do it as an investment, there are always risks that come with investments. And especially if you're borrowing money to try to do this.
Yeah.
If and when it goes wrong, you personally are now on the stick for the amount to the banks. But at the same time, it's about what is your ultimate intention. I think if you remember when we spoke back earlier when we started about succession planning, and this is exactly what it plays into. What is the ultimate goal that you want to achieve? And then you implement the structure. There is a world in which it's okay just to buy it yourself. I mean, if it's a residential property, there's no need to sort of complicate your life.
Yeah.
You can just buy it in your personal capacity or with your partner or spouse, and then you keep it simple. But if you're doing it as an investment, I think that there's always a level of risk that is attendant on that. And there are a lot of other legal relationships that are related to just a simple ownership issue that you are better managing if you're doing it in a separate legal structure.
Give us a call at 011-883-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. Simba Takuva is my guest, director at Takuva Attorneys. He's also a consultant at Mulatudi Incorporated. And we're talking about the property business. Would that be true for an investment for both properties that are going to provide accommodations for, I suppose, residential purposes and commercial purposes?
Yes, it would. I think regardless of whether it's residential or commercial usage, I think that your structuring needs to make sure that you put it in the most efficient legal, tax, and administrative structure that you can manage tenant issues, you can manage agency issues, and you can easily divest or manage your succession issues as well. So I do think that the structuring, it lends itself to either scenario, whether it's corporate or commercial property or whether it's a residential one.
One friend of mine said to me that part of the reason why the suggestion is to put a property like that in some form of a trust, or perhaps a trust that owns the company that owns the building, is if you want to bequeath that property to your children, then issues such as capital gains tax are not necessarily going to be vested in your children. Explain that to me.
Yeah. So, look, I'm not going to put myself on as a tax expert on your very respectable show. But yes, so the part of the structuring has to do with your tax structuring. And I think that, as I'm saying to you, you can look at the legal structure and all of that, and you can talk to Simba, who can help you do all of this. But I think a big part of it, you have to think about the tax structuring. So if your intention is to bequeath it forever and ever and to your children and your progeny, I think that you have to be looking at more inheritance tax issues. And once you put it in a trust structure, you can then deal with the inheritance tax problem, because your children and the grandchildren are already captured as beneficiaries to the trust, and the trust owns this property. And so if anything happens to you as an individual, it doesn't affect that ownership structure. It's already there.
Right.
And then, so then you take away the issue of, oh, now, you know, we have to value the property, and then SARS is waiting right there to do a inheritance tax calculation for you before you can do anything with it, you know?
SARS.
And they're very efficient.
Absolutely. Give us a call at 1-888-303-0702. Do you want to get into the property industry for, to have a business of that nature where you are renting out the property to tenants of whatever sort? Give us a call. I'd love to hear your thoughts. But I want to get now into that issue of how do we protect ourselves from errant, so we call them tenants, and what can we do prior perhaps to getting into that business?
Yeah. So look, this is maybe the most topical question I fielded even after the interview that we had.
Yeah.
And it's actually disheartening when you hear the stories of people who have tenants who have not paid rent for years, and they're just struggling to get them out of the property or to find a solution. So I think the first thing to do is to always make sure that there is a signed lease agreement. A lot of times with tenant issues, you find that there is a squatting issue. So maybe you've inherited this property and there was someone who was living in the property. I think the last time we had a caller who talked about some family members who were staying in the property, but without any documented lease agreement or anything confirming that the terms under which they're staying there. So it always makes it simpler and faster for me as a lawyer when I'm consulting, when someone says, listen, here's my lease agreement with this particular individual, and this is what I think they have breached in the lease agreement. It just puts us puts you in a very strong legal position when you have got a contract already up front, as opposed to when there is no contract or maybe the lease expired and nobody bothered to renew it, which we also hear of a lot. So I think step number one has always got to be make sure that whoever is residing in your property, you know them, you've got a lease with them. And that lease is watertight. It favors you. It gives you recourse, quick recourse, as and when there's a breach by the tenant.
We have laws in this country that suggest that if there is lack of agreement between a tenant and the landlord, and the landlord wants to terminate the lease agreement for whatever, part of what needs to happen is they need to provide alternative accommodations for that person if there's no agreement between them and there is a desire to evict that person. Explain those laws to us. We hear about them all the time.
Yeah. So the most famous one, in fact, the most applicable one to this topic is the PIE Act, Prevention of Illegal Eviction from and Unlawful Occupation of Land Act. So I think we covered a few basics of this act the last time. The purpose of PIE is really, it's to protect both the owners and the tenants. But I think that the problem with the PIE Act is that when it came in to law, it then created an inordinate amount of obligation on the part of the landlord. Because remember, as the landlord, you are the one who has the real desire to free your property of a non-paying tenant so that you can start to make money off of it again. Whereas the tenant, I mean, yes, they might claim to have a desire to pay the rental, but then there is nothing really pushing them to go to court in terms of the PIE Act to try to make sure that the landlord is also doing what he should be doing.
That's right, yeah.
Yes. So, look, as you said, it's an act that was born out of a genuine need to protect tenants in an unfair relationship, right, where you had landlords with all the power and the tenants with no power whatsoever, based on our past.
Yeah.
And you usually would have people being evicted late at midnight or what have you and kicked out of the house and kids are left on the streets. You know, and this is what the act was introduced to try to prevent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The problem, of course, is that as with all good intentions, the implementation has sort of resulted in this, let's say, a bit of a skewed approach where it now looks like you as the landlord, you now have to go and spend all this money on legal fees, trying to make sure you comply with the process. But as I said, the compliance with PIE is really, I hate saying this to clients, but it's a bit of a tick box exercise, right? So yes, there's the spirit of the law, and you need to give notice of breach to the tenants. You have to warn them that you are about to now proceed with eviction procedures if they don't rectify their arrears.
Yeah.
Then once you've done that notice, you then formally issue a letter to evict them in terms of the PIE Act. And then that letter has to be served formally by the sheriff of the court, because the court wants to make sure that that communication actually was delivered to the tenant.
Yes.
Right. So you give that letter to the tenant formally, and then you then, after the sheriff has served that letter, they'll give you a return of service, and then you can then now start the process of actually filing in court the application to have this tenant evicted. And like I say, the statute does make mention of 14 days.
Yeah.
So the service on the tenant has to be a minimum of 14 days before the hearing. And then you have to appear at the hearing. And so you see how costs just keep adding on.
Yeah.
Now you have to, you and your attorney, you appear at the hearing. You then present your issue to the court. Sometimes the tenants do defend themselves. And then from that point onwards, the court makes a decision. And then if it's an eviction, then you have to now start the process of planning for the eviction. Mm. So typically the court will also issue some rules or some guidelines to say, okay, we're giving you 10 days notice, Mr. Tenant. Your property should have been moved out and you must have found alternate accommodation for your family.
Give us a call. My guest is Simba Takuva, Director at Takuva Attorneys. We're talking about the laws, regulations around the relationship between a tenant and their landlord in terms of the law. What have you experienced in this space? Give us a call. I'd love to hear from you. 011-883-0702. And is this something that that, you know, I get the sense, Simba, that a lot of people don't really know how to navigate that process because of the reasons that you've already spoken about legally. In other words, people tend to feel like this law is skewed on the side of the errant tenant. But is there a way of, in the contract that begins the relationship right at the beginning, to have an agreement that says, listen, if we can't agree at some point, then we part ways amicably and without drama?
Yes. So contractually, you can agree this, but then the problem is that the statute and the laws of the country will always take precedence over what you agree as individuals in a contract. So even though you have the contractual agreement and you can sue the tenant for breach of that contract in terms of the provisions of the contract, but the tenant can raise a lawful defense. So let's say in your contract you agree with the tenant, if you breach, I'll give you a notice of eviction and you must be out of my property in 30 days. The tenant can still raise a tie defense. So it can go to court and say, look, this guy wants to evict me, but he's not complying with the act. And you as the landlord will then have to comply with the act because essentially your contractual provision contradicts or is contrary to what the law says should be the process. But I think what's important from a contractual perspective is you can capture certain processes that ensure that you respond early. So a lot of the times with our landlords that we encounter coming to us to seek advice, they leave this for so long that they are now out of money, they have to pay the rates and taxes, the tenant is still not paying, that by the time that they come to consult, they barely have even the legal fees to try to make the case. So this is the issue is, and that's why it's important to have the agreement, because when you have the agreement, you can respond very quickly and very early to a tenant who's already defaulting on rental payments. And then you can save yourself a lot of time and a lot of money by acting quickly to try to get this tenant out of your property. But just also important to mention that, remember that when we're talking about PI, we're really talking on the residential side of things.
Yeah.
So on the commercial side of things, the contract really is very critical, because then we're not really in the realm of the PI Act. So for commercial properties, having a lease agreement is all the more critical, because that's the only document that now really regulates your relationship. And the kind of response and the process that should be followed if there is a default.
Here's a call from Anonymous, who is on the other side of the conversation. She is a tenant that was illegally evicted. Anonymous, good evening to you. Hello, Anonymous.
A very good evening.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good evening. Good evening. Thanks for taking my call. Okay, I rented a place in Johannesburg, the very big company, with an agent. Now, if you go back on my payment profile towards my rent, whenever I had extra money, I paid 2 months, 3 months in advance. However, it was COVID, and my customers didn't pay me. So they sent me a letter to appear in court, which I did. When I got to court, the magistrate went through all the documents and she threw the matter out of court, which means that they shouldn't evict me, but give me a chance to pay because it was COVID at that time. However, I...
So were you in arrears, Anonymous?
I was in like 2 months arrears.
Okay.
And I kept in contact with them. It's not, I'm a responsible person. I'm a single person. And I responded to them, and the lady that was collecting the rent said to me, I wish I had tenants like you that pay in advance and you kept in contact. That was the lady in the collection department. However, when I appeared in court, the magistrate threw this matter out of court, and she said, no, they shouldn't evict me. However, 3 months later, I was quite ill. I even lost my sight.
Uh-huh.
So the next thing, on a Monday morning, the guys came up, the messengers came, and they threw all my stuff on the street. I lost AMC pots. I lost a lot of my stuff that was thrown on the street. Thank God I had a place to move into. And I wanted to know, this happened about 2 years ago, but it's still, you know, it's quite embarrassing for what they did. Could I take them to court for the stuff that I lost? And I didn't get a notice saying that if you don't pay within a couple of days or months, you'll be evicted. But the case was thrown out of court. I had witnesses that took me to court, that stood there, and they said, no, I am quite ill. I had a stroke, and they shouldn't do this. And, you know, it was terrible. It was terrible. I'm still quite ill for what they did.
Sure, sure. So your fundamental question, Anonymous, is what is your legal recourse in this situation, yeah?
They threw my stuff out without notice.
Sure. No, I we get that.
And
Hello, Anonymous. So what, yes, what you would like to find out from Simba is what can you do in this respect?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Simba?
Yeah. No, thank you, Anonymous. And look, I'm so sorry to hear about that experience. I think where you need to start, obviously, you said it's about 2 years. So I think you are within the prescription timelines. What didn't come out clearly to me was this a residential property that you were renting, or was this your commercial rental?
Oh, no, she's gone now. She's gone.
Oh, is she off?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't really catch that part. But yeah, look, to the extent that it was a residential property, then that eviction would be an illegal eviction. And I think that for the damages that she has incurred, she will have a right of recourse in court, and it will just be a question of quantifying those damages and clearly outlining that those damages arose because of the way that she was unlawfully evicted from the premises. Remember that even if it's a lawful eviction, the courts will always have instructions relating to how to ensure that the moving of the items, of the goods, from that premises must be done in a way that does not cause damage to those goods and those items. So it's really important, you know, that it doesn't end up being kind of what we used to see in the past, the red ants just coming in and throwing people's TVs and everything onto a truck and sort of hurtling off into the distance, irregardless of you know, trying to make sure that those things are not damaged. So I think that we just need to maybe see what further detail she has of the way these things were moved, and the causation element for the damages that were caused and the quantifying of the damages. But it does sound to me like she would have recourse.
So practically she would need to go to an attorney such as yourself, and and of course that would be the process you'd need to follow, yeah?
Yes, that'll be the queries that they would give her, that they would have, is just give us more details of the facts, and then they would then start to build the case from there. But she needs to do it fairly quickly, because if it's been 2 years already, then it's getting perilously close to the prescription timeline, which is 3 years. So
okay, so there's a prescription a timeline here as well to consider.
Yeah, So prescription does apply. So in terms of our law, generally, from the time you became aware of the damage, you have to have taken steps to try to recover that amount within 3 years, and you can interrupt prescription in a number of ways. I don't want to get too technical with it. But yes, essentially you do have 3 years to try to bring your issue to court, or at least to try to get recourse for the damages that occurred.
Listen, I'm getting some very interesting news here, Simba. There's a young man by the name of Maxwell with his brother Daniel.
Oh, yeah.
You may know these two young men. They've just sent us a message to say that they're listening to one Simba Takuva, who happens to be their dad. I've just got the message now that they're listening to you right now. Maxwell is at school at the moment, at boarding school, and Daniel is at home. And both of your young sons are listening to you speak to us on radio. And they just wanted to send you a shout out. I just got the message right now.
That's awesome.
Both
your boys, thank you.
They're both listening to you right now. All right. Let's just take the situation that you pointed to say, if it is a residential situation, then she definitely has recourse. It sounds to me that if it is a commercial relationship of some sort, then the terms would be different. Talk to us
not
about
necessarily
that.
So I think if it were commercial, then we would just need to then look at it in a delictual sense. So if the landlord, even if the landlord is entitled in terms of the contract to evict or was entitled to evict her in that scenario, then there's still the question of there should have been due care and diligence taken to ensure that the goods are not damaged or her property or movable assets are not damaged. And if they did damage those items, then there would be a claim in terms of our normal delictual law.
Yeah.
Alternatively, to the extent that the eviction would not even have complied with the contract or the terms of the contract of how the eviction process should be done, then she could also have a claim in terms of our contract laws for breach of contract in the way that they did that. Sometimes you have an amalgamation of the two, but like I said, it will depend on the facts. The only thing that really becomes different is that in that case, in a commercial case, you are dealing with a contract, a contractual relationship. Whereas in a residential place, yes, you can still have a look at the contract, but there is this overarching law called PI, which you can then bring your action in terms of.
Etienne is in Johannesburg. Hi, Etienne.
Hi, Aubrey. Can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear. Go ahead, Etienne.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Hello, Simba. How are you?
Good. Etienne, how are you doing today?
I'm very good. I just have a little situation here. I'm not sure if it's in line of what you're just talking now. But it actually stays in one of the flats, and our next door neighbor smoked a lot of dacha. And I've got two little kids. One is 10 and one is 1 year. So they get a lot of the fumes, a lot of things coming into our flat. And I know it's illegal in terms of smoking your own premises. But in this situation, what are the laws and why it's actually allowed to smoke in a flat?
Okay, so obviously this isn't a situation a tenant versus landlord kind of situation. But would you care to perhaps give Etienne some assistance there, please, Simba?
I'd love to. Just clarify for me, Etienne. I don't know if you're still on or Aubrey, if you might catch.
He's still here.
I'm still on.
Okay. So is it a question where the neighbor has been, you said, was it a slaughtering issue? I didn't quite get the...
No. The neighbor enjoys a spliff too often. While it is, I think this is what Etienne said, while it is legal for you to, in your premises, smoke dacha, what is the law as it pertains to the fact that smoke goes into my flat? And in my case, or in Etienne's case, he's got two young children that are affected by that smoke. What are the legalities and recourse in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, this is and thanks Etienne for that question. It's very interesting. I think what the questions that it raises are really, there's competing rights. So obviously the neighbor will say, I have a right to partake of the herb in my own premises, and this right is protected by law. But there's now neighbor rights as well, which are there to protect Etienne from certain conduct that is being done by the neighbor, which affects their enjoyment of their premises as well.
Yeah.
I think if it's a complex Etienne, what I would start off with is by trying to look at your bylaws in your complex. See if there isn't any way you can raise this to the body corporate that manages the complex and try to get a resolution. So whether it's that maybe whenever he chooses to smoke, or he or she, I should say, actually, that they should close the windows, or they should have some kind of a vacuum kind of installation to make sure that this smoke does not end up also flowing over to your house and causing the trouble. So I think maybe your first point of recourse might be body corporate. If I may ask, is the neighbor an owner or a tenant?
I'm a neighbor.
Your neighbor is your neighbor the owner of the flat, are they a tenant themselves?
They are also a tenant, just like me. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think you could also raise it with the landlord of that neighbor, because most leases sometimes will have rules around that you can't smoke in the house. Yeah. And if the tenant is busy doing that, then that might be grounds for their lease to be terminated. But obviously you wouldn't know what's in the lease. That's an agreement between the landlord and the tenant who just happens to be your neighbor. So yeah. I would say certainly start with the body corporate. See if you can get some recourse from that. And that's, of course, I'm assuming that by the time you're calling in, that probably you have tried to raise this with the neighbor, and the neighbor is not willing to desist from this behavior.
Yeah, I've done it a couple of times. Yes, yeah.
Etienne, yeah. Good luck to you, man. Etienne, good luck, man.
Yeah.
To you on that. Yeah, I suppose those are the issues that will invariably come out of a conversation around property and landlords and tenants. But let me ask my listeners to keep it within the realms of the relationship between a tenant and their landlord and the issues that might arise out of that. I'm sure Simba's happy to lend some of his expertise to that conversation. But
yeah.
For now, we are focused on that particular issue. Edwin is in Midrand. Hi, Edwin.
Hi, how is it?
Very good, thanks. Go ahead, Edwin.
Thank you. I just wanted to say the relation to the occupants that are being evicted from properties.
Yeah.
I think one of the questions you raised is the issue relating to alternative accommodation.
Yeah.
Well, normally the municipalities on which area of jurisdiction the property is based are required and enjoined in terms of the law, especially the case law and PI, of course, to offer alternative accommodation to those who are in need of such alternative accommodation.
Yeah.
So it's not like when you are evicted with your family, you will be spending some nights out in the street. What normally the court will do is either during the proceedings, they will issue an order directing the municipality to provide what you normally refer to as a T report. Temporary emergency accommodation report, so that the magistrate or the judge has got an idea as to, if I grant this eviction application, where are these people going to? Then the municipality will come and say, look, in terms of my policy, I have assessed their personal circumstances, because that's one area where the court must look into. And I think that the municipality, I can give them temporary emergency accommodation. People normally last, for example, 6 months. While they're still finding their feet in order to go and get property for their own. So it's not all doom and gloom for those who are
tenants in this situation. So
yes.
let me understand, Edwin. You're saying to me that the landlord would need to also liaise somehow with the municipality to say, listen, I have issues with this particular tenant and I'm going to start proceedings for eviction. You, in terms of the law, are required to help me find alternative accommodation for the tenant that I'm going to evict. Is that what effectively you say?
You're correct, Aubrey, in the sense that when you issue eviction proceedings, it is a requirement that you must cite the municipality of the area of jurisdiction where the property is based. Now, when you cite the municipality, two things happen. One, normally the court will say, since there is the second respondent or whatever respondent in the form of the municipality, and they should provide alternative accommodation in terms of the law. I want them to give me a report so that when I make a decision as a judge, I then know whether if these people will be able to get accommodation or not. Alternatively, the policy requires, some municipalities' policy require that once there are eviction proceedings, the evictees, as we normally call them, should approach the offices of the municipality and say, look, here there is an eviction application, and I can tell you now, if it is granted, it will render me homeless with my family. Therefore, assess my situation and see if you are able to provide me with alternative accommodation. But that information or that report should come to the attention of the court so that when the court grants eviction, because normally will not want to throw people out of the street without any accommodation provided to them, unless in an unlikely circumstances. But yeah, that report should be there so that the court knows how to deal with the matter.
Edwin, thanks very much, my brother, for your contribution. The municipality, wouldn't the municipality have some sort of argument to say, listen, you didn't consult me when you went into this deal to begin with. Now, why do I need to be the one that has the responsibility of providing accommodation in this particular situation? Tell me about that relationship, please, Simba.
Yeah. No, Edwin is very right. So when you do serve your eviction notice to the tenant, the sheriff also needs to serve it on the municipality. And for the reasons that the municipality has to conduct that assessment to see if they can arrange alternate accommodation or temporary accommodation for the evictee, as he says. So, yes, I can see where your wonder is here about why would the municipality now be getting involved when two people who entered into their own agreement. And I think the point goes back to
the law.
So if, just imagine this, the law, remember, as I said earlier, is intended to protect an evictee and the family from ending up being entirely homeless. And I think Edwin really summarized it well to say, the job of the municipality is then to try to identify if it's a really bad situation and the tenant is totally indigent, they can't secure any alternate accommodation, even if you gave them a 30-day notice of the actual eviction, then the municipality then needs to kick in order to provide this temporary accommodation. And I think it not only helps the tenant, but it also helps the landlord, because if there isn't that alternate accommodation available, then it will be very, very difficult for the court to allow the landlord to evict this tenant without any temporary arrangements being available. Yeah. So it is a legal requirement, and I think that it's there in order to try to help move the process forward rather than for the process to sort of deadlock where the tenant says, well, I have nowhere else to go. And the landlord says, but I need you to get out of my property. Then they tried then to introduce the municipality there, and the municipalities now are enjoined to make sure that they try to have these properties or these temporary accommodations available, just to try to cater for this kind of scenario. But I must say that in my own experience, most of the time you just have a tenant maybe who is sort of going into a bit of a temporary financial trouble. I mean, similar to the earlier caller who said, look, I temporarily just was ill. My clients had not paid me, so I didn't have cash for 1 or 2 months. But then that tenant has sources of income. Maybe you have relatives. Maybe you are able to apply for another property, even if it might be cheaper. And then you can move into an alternate property on your own cognizance without necessarily having to go to the municipalities. Yeah, yeah. So it tends to be that the municipal process or the municipal notice oftentimes is a formality, and the municipalities typically will just give a list of all the properties that they have that are available. which are available as temporary accommodation. But most tenants would not want to go there. You will find that most of the time they just want to make their own plan. They just need to be given a bit of time to formalize their own arrangements.
Simba, lots of questions coming up, and a lot of people wanting to talk to you specifically and privately about their particular issues. How do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, please. They can contact me directly on email. My email is simba.takuva@takuvalaw.com, or they can give us a call on 010-211-9068.
Simba Takuva, Director at Takuva Attorneys and Consultant at Mulat Dudi Incorporated. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much, Aubrey. Have a good evening.